Serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a visit with an accomplished Air Force general, Robert Titus. We've heard how he enlisted in the Army during World War II, became a paratrooper with the 82nd Airborne, was even training to jump into Japan when the first atomic bomb was dropped, so thankfully he never had to make that jump. We heard how he became an Air Force fighter pilot, completing more than 100 missions during the Korean War, his time as a test pilot, including the very first jet mission over the North Pole in 1959, that led to another Distinguished Flying Cross, but now we have the time machine set at 50 years ago. And in the span of 3 days in May of 1967, his aerial exploits in Vietnam earned him 2 of our nation's highest military honors. First, the Silver Star, then 2 days later, the Air Force Cross. Let's start with May 20th, 1967, when you shot down your first MiG in your F-4 Phantom II.
We were escorting some F-105s down what is called Thud Ridge. It's a mountain ridge that runs northwest to southeast right into Hanoi. We were airborne, and I saw a MiG, and I broke off and announced that I was engaging a MiG. He was in a descending turn to the left, and there was mountains in the background. And so the Sidewinders, which are a heat-seeking missile, were not valid at that date and time because of too much background radiation. So I hooked up with a radar homing missile. Now, that was an AIM-7 Sparrow missile, and you'd lock onto the target and transmit information to the missile, and the missile then would guide to the target. However, I fired the first missile, and it didn't guide. I never saw it. And my backseat is saying, fire another one. I fired another one, and it too didn't guide. And I thought I was going to have to ram this guy. But finally, the third missile hit him in the wing root, and he ejected. And I was amazed that he had what looked like a Martin Baker seat, an ejection seat. I thought, how about it? It's got the same kind of a ejection seat system that we have. So I was kind of pumped on that.
Yeah, was that kind of a watershed moment for you? Here you'd been in combat in a P-51. You'd been in the F-86 and never had that experience of going toe-to-toe with an enemy fighter like that.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was a thrill because, again, I'd been wanting to shoot down an airplane since I was a kid.
Yeah, well, and there you did. But shooting down two in the same mission is bigger than shooting down one, and you received the Air Force Cross. The only thing higher that you could have gotten is the Medal of Honor. I mean, this is a prestigious, prestigious medal. May 22nd, 1967. It sounds like maybe that same route that you just talked about, huh?
Essentially, yeah. This time I was taking a flight of 8 in to provide cover, and we're heading east toward the target area, as I recall, probably about 16, 17,000 feet, in position to look at the box of F-105s. I don't recall, there were 12 or so of them, 3 flights of 4, as I recall. In any event, there were a couple of instances. I saw a flash out to the sunlight reflecting off other aircraft, obviously, out to my 1 o'clock position, and they went off to the right, and I followed them for a while, and I determined that they were no longer a threat to the strike force, so I was concerned about being in position over the flight protecting the strike force, so I went back to where I should have been. And I called for a jettison of the external tanks because I'm figuring, okay, the MiGs are up and they're engaging. I looked over my shoulder and I saw 2 MiGs coming up our 6 o'clock position, and they were firing missiles. And I called for a break, went a hard left turn, and then as the MiGs went by, I reversed, and the one went up. I saw the one. I put my pipper on him in the gun sight and got a good growling tone from a Sidewinder missile and released the Sidewinder missile. And it flew right up his tailpipe. He exploded. And then I looked out, and here's another MiG at my 1 o'clock position. So I headed for him, and he then made a hard diving turn, and we went through a series of... This time I had a 61-millimeter gun pod, but I had no computing sight. All I had was a pipper. Anyway, when he finally had to roll out, I put my pipper in front of him and just pulled the trigger and hosed him down the center, and he conveniently crashed. So that was the second one. That's how it was.
That's how it was. Well, here's what the Air Force said about it. They said, the President of the United States of America takes pleasure in presenting the Air Force Cross to Lieutenant Colonel Robert F. Titus for extraordinary heroism in military operations against an opposing armed force as an F-4C mission commander in the 389th Tactical Fighter Squadron, 366th Tactical Fighter Wing, Da Nang Air Base, Vietnam, in action near Hanoi, North Vietnam, on 22 May 1967. On that date, Colonel Titus led his flight into one of the most heavily defended areas of North Vietnam in direct support of F-105 strike aircraft operations. Undaunted by accurate flak and five surface-to-air missiles that were launched at his aircraft, he repeatedly and unhesitatingly engaged numerous MiG-21s in defense of the friendly aircraft. During these aggressive and courageous aerial encounters, Colonel Titus destroyed two MiG-21 aircraft. As a direct result of his tenacity and extreme bravery in the face of great danger, the F-105 force was able to accomplish its assigned mission. Through his extraordinary heroism, superb airmanship, and aggressiveness in the face of hostile forces, Lieutenant Colonel Titus reflected the highest credit upon himself and the United States Air Force. How's that sound?
Sounds a little inflated, don't you think?
Well, you tell me. You didn't say anything about the five surface-to-air missiles launched at your plane.
Well, I was vaguely aware of their presence, but I couldn't concern myself with them. I was occupied with the enemy fighter.
How close do you think they came to you?
I have no idea. There was a lot of flak, I know that. But, again, I was not interested in the flak. My wingman said later, he said, all I can think is I'm watching my squadron commander get shot down. But, you know, my job was to get the MiG.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't he saying that because that was probably the likely outcome of the situation you found yourself in?
It's probably close.
And it would have been probably not just you shot down, but some of those F-105 shot down.
Could have been.
So that incident, you're awarded the Air Force Cross for. Do you take some pride in that? Was it a proud moment when they pinned it on you?
You know, the only thing I can say about combat decorations is that, as I told somebody earlier some years ago, they decorate you for things that you don't think are particularly significant, and the things that you thought were really spectacular that you accomplished, no one noticed.
Well, here's your chance. What are some of those things that no one noticed that when you look back on a career that really has spanned the entire existence of the Air Force, what are the things that you think were noteworthy or you're proud of?
Well, I think when I was flying F-5s in South Vietnam, there was a mission. We were airborne, and I had napalm and 20-millimeter ammo. There was an emergency call. There was a Mike force, which was a long-range reconnaissance force led by Americans using Hnung mercenaries. These were Chinese convicts who had been let out of jail to fight in the war, and they were trained by the Americans, and they were out, and they were surrounded by Viet Cong. And they're in desperate straits. The only problem was it was an undercast, and I was above that. But I responded to the call to the control center. They put me in touch, gave me a frequency so I could contact the guys on the ground. I was whispering into the microphone. Anyway, we've got dead and wounded, and we're surrounded, and I need napalm. And I said, well, I'd be happy to help to the extent that I can, but I can't see. I don't know where you are. And he said, I can hear you. You're south of me. Come north. And anyway, through some activity like that, I let down blind through an undercast. I flew over his position, and I did a 9270 to come back, as I told him, to release some smoke, which he didn't want to do until I was in position. And he released the smoke, and I said, where do you want it in relation to smoke? He said, I want it on the smoke. And I thought, you sure you want it that close? Absolutely. And I put two cans of napalm on the smoke. Anyway, they extricated themselves, and that broke the perimeter of enemy. That night, I was in the squadron bar, which is a room about half this size, and there was somebody at the door, a guy in grease paint and soft hat, and he's looking for me. My guy said, what are you looking for him for?
Ready to defend you, huh?
Let him in. He brought a bottle of champagne and a red, white, and blue scarf, which they wore as a present for me, and I became pretty closely associated with those guys after that. But it was a good feeling to know that you were able to help your comrades on the ground. That's what it's all about.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand that scenario, and we talked earlier about the possibility of friendly fire, when he says, I want it on the smoke, you're saying, well, that might kill you.
That's what I'm thinking.
But you trust him, he trusts you, and in reality, you risked your life coming down blind through that overcast to that position to save theirs.
Well, the job is there, you know. The devil take the hindmost. You've got to do the best you can to provide the support that he requires. That's the camaraderie. That's what it's all about. You know, to me, I just get down to that's what is, and it's never occurred to me to deviate from that thought process.
And you were in the Air Force with that rank of Brigadier General, but that didn't end your flying days by any means.
No, I flew up until the day before I retired.
And the impact of the F-15 program? I mean, these are planes that are still in use today.
Great airplane.
What was your role in the development and deployment of F-15s?
When I was a major at TAC headquarters, working for General Graham, he called me in one day and said, write a general operational requirement for a new air superiority fighter. And we got to be able to meet the big beat the MiGs in Europe. At that time, of course, Russia and the Eastern Bloc was our predominant enemy. So we set out to put together, well, I wrote a requirement with his approval, establishing the performance parameters of an air superiority fighter. And then I went to Vietnam, and 2 years later when I came back, they assigned me to the Pentagon to be the program element monitor for the concept formulation of the F-15. We took the contract in 70, first flight was in 72, initial operational capability, first operational squadron, 1975. That's fast compared to today. F-35's been in design and production for forever, and now they cost Lord knows how much each.
Is there something about how the F-15 turned out or the impact globally of the F-15's effectiveness that you take specific pride in?
Well, I think it's a great airplane. We designed it to be. Remember, we used to say you can do a 3G turn and climb it to 30,000 feet a minute, and that'll roll your socks down. And at the time, first flight, as I say, in 1972, a remarkable level of performance. I mean, it's a Mach 2 airplane, right? What are they building today? Mach 2 airplanes.
Yeah.
40 years later.
Yeah.
More than 40 years later. So, you know, we've pushed the envelope pretty much as far as it can go in terms of air-breathing fighters. Yeah, they can pull high Gs now, and they can go negative, and they can do all kinds of things. And they've got $100,000 helmets so they can see below them and right behind them and all that. But I'm asking, who's the designated enemy? We knew what the requirement was for an F-15. We defined an airplane to meet that requirement.
It's a hard turn from the F-15 back to the P-51, but 60 years after you made the last P-51 flight, you went up in a Mustang again?
Indeed, I did, and that was a wonderful experience to go out there to Petaluma and engage in that event. And I enjoyed getting in the cockpit, you know, the smell of the glycol. I had an experience some years ago. This had to be at about 1971 or 72 when I was stationed with the first fighter wing down at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida. And we stopped on the way back from a trip back east at Tyndall Air Force Base in the Panhandle of Florida. And I spent the night there and went out to my Phantom the next day. And there was a sergeant there who was obviously pretty close to retirement. And there was a Mustang parked across from my airplane. I went out and looked in the cockpit, smelled the glycol, walked back to my airplane, and the sergeant said, I'm sure he must have been in World War II, said, you used to fly those, didn't you, Colonel? I said, well, as a matter of fact, I did. How'd you know? He said, I saw you patted on the tail when you walked away. I said, it brings back memories. Yeah, I loved flying that airplane.
Well, you mentioned the smell. How about the sound?
Great sound. I was walking down in the stadium one day at a football game, and three Mustangs came through, and I stopped and grabbed my throat. I was clutched up, and my wife said, it's okay, honey. I said, you don't know what a thrill that is.
Now, you've had an incredible career, and I imagine there isn't much that you have not done, but is there one aircraft or one experience that you haven't had that you would still like to have at age 90?
I can't say that I need to go back, you know. I don't live in yesterday, and I don't worry about tomorrow. Who's the famous Chinese philosopher who said, yesterday is depression, tomorrow's anxiety, live for the moment? And I kind of conduct myself in that light. I'm not concerned about things that I could have done or things that I didn't do. I've enjoyed the things I've had the opportunity to do and the people that I've gotten to know. And I have great memories of great Air Force fighter pilots, Navy fighter pilots, Marine fighter pilots, great soldiers. I've had some marvelous associations with some of the finest military people that have ever served. And that, to me, is my greatest experience.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to ask you. I know there are a lot of people that look up to you. But who would you say are the people that you see as heroes or role models or people who should be celebrated?
Well, my 82nd Airborne Division Commander, General Jim Gavin, who jumped into Normandy as a 38-year-old Major General with the 82nd Airborne Division and led the victory parade up Fifth Avenue, later became Ambassador to France, was a hero. And he was a hero to me because I remember standing out with the entire division on parade at Fort Bragg. The senior officers were arriving in their staff cars and going into the reviewing stand. We're all just standing there, waiting for the parade to start, and somebody realized that here comes a lone figure off in the distance, walking toward the reviewing stand. No one realized what it was initially, but then the word, "That's General Gavin." And I thought, wow, what an exemplary display of leadership. Made me real proud. And taught me a lesson, valuable lesson.
On the flip side of that, you have counseled, advised, mentored so many young pilots, guys coming through the Air Force Academy here in Colorado Springs. What's the most important advice that you can share for those young people who are going to make that choice to put their lives on the line?
Well, I give them the same old story, you know. Guide yourself by the cardinal virtues. Remember, duty. As Robert E. Lee said, duty is the most sublime word in the English language. No one can do more. No one should ever expect to do less. That's what I told Chad Hennings and any number of other football players that I sponsored at the Academy. Chad and I still are in contact. I talked with Chad the other day. And, you know, he went on to win 3 Super Bowl rings.
Yeah.
At the Dallas Cowboys. Great man. A man of high integrity and honor and self-discipline.
Maybe this is a tough question. And as I work to it, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country for so long and for taking the time to share a few of your experiences with us. Is there something that you would say that you are most proud of?
It's a privilege to serve your country and honor God. That's all there is.
And I can see in your eyes that you mean that with every ounce of your being.
Well, God and family.
Is there anything else I didn't ask you about that you want people to hear?
I can't imagine that I've got much to tell anybody.
Well, I think we all know better than that by now. General Robert Titus, 90 years old. You'll find photos and other links at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. There is one story we didn't hear, how he acquired the nickname Earthquake. He insists it was just randomly assigned early on in his pilot days because he didn't have a nickname. My theory, maybe it was simply foreshadowing what would truly become a groundbreaking career. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.